So today we are continuing this series of classes, this series of discussions on Krishna's abode, Krishna's world, entering Krishna's world. And so I picked this verse from the Brahma Samhita today, which describes something of Krishna's abode. It's a very special, transcendental, shining abode that Sri Krishna inhabits with his associates. Translation. The super excellent station of Krishna, which is known as Gokul, has thousands of petals and a corolla like that of a lotus sprouted from a part of his infinitary aspect, the whirl of the leaves being the actual abode of Krishna. So I'll read a few more verses from the Brahma Samhita. This is the second text. This is 3. The whirl of that transcendental lotus is the realm wherein dwells Krishna. It is a hexagonal figure, the abode of the indwelling, predominated and predominating aspect of the Absolute. Like a diamond, the central supporting figure of self-luminous Krishna stands as the transcendental source of all potencies. The holy name, consisting of 18 transcendental letters, is manifested in a hexagonal figure with sixfold divisions. The whirl of that eternal realm, Gokul, is the hexagonal abode of Krishna. Its petals are the abodes of gopis, who are part and parcel of Krishna, to whom they are most lovingly devoted and are similar in essence. The petals shine beautifully like so many walls. The extended leaves of that lotus are the garden-like dham, i.e. the spiritual abode of Sri Radhika, the most beloved of Krishna. So these are just a few verses. Obviously, in this chapter 5 of the Brahma Samhita, which is really the only chapter that we have, there are many, many more descriptions of the spiritual world, even some indications of the material world. There are beautiful descriptions of Krishna. But these three give us a little hint of this beautiful place where Krishna inhabits. Om jnana timirandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha namo vishnu vinaya krishna krishna. So when we speak about entering Krishna's world, I was thinking that there are a few different aspects to this. There is the place that we can say is Krishna's world. And we could describe it perhaps in terms that we are familiar with when we describe places in this world. You know, you ask, what is the scenery? What is the weather like? What do people do there? You could even ask, what are the laws that operate in that place? Maybe what are the laws of physics? Now, obviously, if we're only restricted to one planet, we don't ask that last question. What are the laws of physics? But if you consider other lokas, other planets, other destinations, you may well have to ask that question. What are the laws of physics that operate? Maybe there's a different type of mathematics. Maybe there's a different biology, a different chemistry. The environment is composed of all of these laws. And we can just term them laws of nature. So these are typically the concepts in our mind when we consider a place. You know, how does it look? What can we do there? What are the facilities available? What is the ground? Is it a desert? Is it the ocean? So this relates to the physical place. And the verses I read today are similar to that type of description. They describe what Gokul looks like. It has thousands of petals. There is a lotus. It looks like a lotus has sprouted from a part of the Lord's infinite aspect. Then there are then there's a hexagonal kind of region where in the diamond, like a diamond, in the center of it, Lord Krishna stands, glistening. Diamonds are very exquisite, very beautiful. They shine and glimmer. And this is Krishna. His entire abode is like that, Chintamani touchstone. And Krishna is standing in the middle of it. And then it describes how this special feature also contains different inhabitants. And these are the gopis and the devotees of Krishna. And so we may also ask, you know, if we're thinking about going to a place, who else is there? You always hear stories of people moving into a house and then They've encountered the neighbors from hell. Well, even if their house may have been the dream home, well, the rest of their experience is misery because the people there may make it hell. So when we consider a place in this material world, you may also ask, what are the people that will be there? What do they do? What are their operating principles? How do they think? What motivates them? And so this could be maybe a second aspect of considering a region or considering a world. What do people do? How do they think? What is their mindset? Now, Krishna is obviously the Supreme Lord. He is infinite by any kind of measurement, if that's possible. In fact, the word infinite itself means you cannot put a number to it. It's just a concept. It's not a real number in mathematics. It just states that we can never get to the end of it. And Krishna, as he is infinite, really there's no description that you could offer that would fully, completely describe Krishna. Because any words would be insufficient to describe him. Yet, there may be a way that Krishna views things which we can kind of put our finger on and sort of condense for our own benefit. We could consider, what does Krishna think when he looks upon this material world? If he looks upon this material world, in the Bhagavatam it describes that this world is a moga lila. It's spotless. And Prabhupada explains this place is a spotless creation of the Lord. There is no flaw in it. There's no mistake in this material world. Now, when we look at the material world, we whinge about it every single day. The material world is this, it's that, there's so much this going on, and Kali Yuga. And we can complain. We have endless complaints about the material world. And perhaps that's also necessary as part of our progress to the spiritual world, to actually understand the deficiencies of this material world, which are genuinely there from our conditioned perspective. So we can ask the question, putting aside our conditioned perspective, when Krishna looks at this material world, what does he think? What is his vision? Well, he sees a place. He sees a place which he ordered to be created. And Prabhupada explains this material world has been created. It's like a toy. It's like a playing cradle, Prabhupada says, that's given to a baby. And the baby wants to play. It's naughty. It's crying. It's given a playing cradle to sit in and have some fun and throw things around. So this material world has been created for the naughty conditioned souls, Prabhupada says, the nitya baddha. They're always naughty. They're always conditioned. And they hang around here in this world. Well, this is why the world is created. They need some place to operate. So that's what Krishna is seeing. He's seeing that he's created this realm where all the nitya badas are hanging out. Then he also sees that, actually, I don't want them to be nitya badas. I don't want everyone just to be enjoying themselves and suffering in this material world. I would ultimately like if they came back to me. So then out of his great kindness, he decides to appear in a few places and executes different pastimes according to his lila, his agenda. He does different things. Then he sends his devotees, he sends his acharyas, he sends his parampara with varying different paramparas with varying degrees of, you could say, accuracy or strength of adherence to the principles. But he does send genuine gurus. He sends genuine gurus in each of the paramparas. And then he also sends his books, shastra. So Krishna is looking at this world, and he sees the naughty conditioned souls. He himself decides to appear. He brings his abode here. Then he also gives us literature. And then he also wants something. When he looks at this world, he also observes that people are running around. They are engaged in this they're engaged in very busily doing things. They're running around all day. If you just go out to any road and just sit there and watch for a moment, hundreds of vehicles will be going back and forth. If you go to a bigger junction, obviously the Birmingham Spaghetti Junction is quite famous. If you just go there or if you fly over there, you just look down and it's just like a maze of arteries, of cars going here, there and everywhere. So Krishna's watching all this, and on a much grander scale, because he sees all the countries of the world, and he sees all the movements of all the living entities. And he's thinking, these people are all running around, doing things, laboring hard for things that will all perish. And so he sees that as being an extremely sad situation. This is Krishna's vision. This is what he sees when he looks at this material world. But then he also sees that, okay, now that I've given my books, my dham, my personal association at times, there are some persons who are making a determined effort to exit. And Krishna is very pleased by that. He decides to pay more attention to those people. The rest of it's all handled by Maya. He doesn't need to get involved. He just deputizes it to her and she deals with it. And every living entity gets poked nicely by Maya's trident. The three modes. She pokes them nicely with, you could say, goodness, passion, ignorance. Also adibhautik, adidevik, adiatmic, miseries. And so they get a nice roasting just from other agents of the Lord in this world. But Krishna sees some devotees trying to move towards him. And he inspires them. He encourages them. Sometimes he even appears to them. Sometimes he gives them a chance to have an insight into his character, an insight into his world. Sometimes he does that. He gives a little darshan, a little glimpse. And sometimes he empowers his great devotees to carry out that work on his behalf. So just consider the scene when Krishna looks at this world. That entire vision is quite different to the vision of one of these people driving along the spaghetti junction at Birmingham, for example, or London, or anywhere else. This person in this little vehicle driving around is thinking, how can I enjoy myself today? I have a list of duties that I must complete today. I have so much economic development, industrial development, this, that, so many tasks to complete. And I will get my happiness at the end of the day, whatever it is for each person, and at night. And I will enjoy myself. And then I'll go into hospital next week and have this operation that I've been waiting for. It's quite a different vision. The vision of this little individual who is meandering through this material world is one of temporary, only this lifetime based activities and concerns. How do I maintain my body? How do I give yet another dose of sense gratification to my senses, which have been amply fed all my life and are still not satisfied? That's what the typical living entity is thinking. How can I satisfy my senses, or by extension, the senses of those who are close to me, or those who I like? And then maybe by extension, the senses of my country. How can I do something good for my country? I'll become the prime minister. Maybe that's someone's thought. I'll become in some responsible position. I'll become the president. Prabhupada says this is personal sense gratification and extended sense gratification. Your goal is to increase the sensory enjoyment and reduction of material misery of others in this world. That's quite a different outlook to Krishna. Krishna is looking at all these people and thinking they're wasting their time because they're focusing on something that is asat, temporary. And Krishna is thinking, and there are some who are progressing back to me. How can I inspire my devotees to bring more people back to me? So if that's Krishna's vision, if that's the way Krishna thinks, we can get a glimpse as to how we need to think if we are going to be aligned to Krishna's plan. If we want to enter Krishna's world, we have to have thinking which is aligned to Krishna. We don't have anything else that we can bring to Krishna. We can't bring him any opulence. We can't bring him power. We can't bring him beauty, anything else, strength, fame, even renunciation. You can't say to Krishna, Krishna, I'm the most renounced brahmachari, the most renounced yogi. I am dudahari. I just eat, drink a little bit of milk, and that's my subsistence. You can't say that to Krishna, because Krishna can do more renunciation than anyone, everyone put together in just a moment. And he can continue that for lifetimes. Whole worlds can come and go, and Krishna can still be in meditation, in trance, in yoga nidra. You can't impress Krishna with any item you take, but you can impress him or align yourself to him with consciousness. which is the only independent quality we have. Everything else is Krishna's anyway. It's either his directly or his energies. The only thing we have is our free will, which stems from the fact that we are conscious, individual, living entities. Now, if we align our consciousness and our thinking closer to Krishna, and when we look at the world, ourselves, instead of rushing from A to B, trying to do things which are only of benefit for a very limited time scale and have a prime purpose of sense gratification, we can look at it more from Krishna's perspective. To do those things that bring eternal or long-lasting happiness and welfare to all the conditioned living entities. That is Krishna's thinking. As a devotee aligns himself, herself more and more towards that program, they start to be connected to Krishna in a consciousness, on a level of consciousness. And that's quite different to the abode. Here in this material world, the abode is quite important, and the abode is a limiting factor in many cases. Okay, we have a temple room, and it can seat 200 people maybe. There's only a certain amount you can do in the temple room. Okay, so let's build a haveli. Okay, the haveli is a bit bigger. It can seat maybe 300, 400 people. Still a limit. Then you might get a big tent like the big top we used to get for Janmashtami. Maybe 1,000 people you can get inside there. Still, the facilities limit you. Krishna's world, his abode, his divine realm that I mentioned here in the Brahma, that's mentioned in the Brahma Samhita, the verse that we read, is not constrained by any measurements, any facilities, or any resources. Here you have a limited range of building materials. There, anything that you need can be automatically manifested. There are kalpavriksha trees, there are kamadhenu cows, any ingredients, any items, any realms, any weather that's required is produced on demand by those who make Krishna's arrangements, by the influence of yoga maya. So in one sense, learning the descriptions of the place is not so useful or not so complete an understanding of the spiritual world. Because we always look at the descriptions of a place here, and as I mentioned, the scenery, the people, the resources, the wealth, things like that, we can do something similar for the spiritual world, and therefore some descriptions are given here. But the fact is that the world and in the environment is constructed and reconstructed on the fly, manifested, unmanifested, according to the specific needs of the pastime, by all the agents of the Lord. So it's not the prime. It shouldn't be the prime feature that attracts us. Of course, we like the idea of going to a place where there are kalpavriksha trees, there's nice clear lakes, when we're drinking the London recycled water, which is recycled 7 times or 8 times or something like that before we get to it. So we like the idea of some nice fresh scenery, but it's not the real thing. It's there, it helps us connect with the spiritual world, which is far, far better than anything you can dream of here. But consciousness is perhaps one of the most important qualities. When our consciousness is aligned to Krishna, we start to do things that will be pleasing to Krishna. And in the spiritual world, we just read about the gopis, what they do for Krishna. The Lakshmis, thousands of gopis and Lakshmis are constantly serving Krishna. What they do for him to give him pleasure. What do the acharyas do when they come to this material world? They look at all the fallen, conditioned souls. They look at all the difficulties that they undergo. They look at all the stresses and strains that they have, and they desire to lift them out. When that happens, and that is Krishna's vision, the two persons are aligned. And in one sense, in the Bhagavatam, it describes that there is a sense of oneness with the Lord. Now, the Mayavadis like to take this concept and spin it into something else. They say oneness means you become the Lord, or you become an identical replica of the Lord, just as powerful and just as competent. Or maybe you can become one with the Lord in the sense that neither of you actually exist, and there's just this unlimited one light. So this is how oneness can be manipulated according to different agendas. But Srila Prabhupada explains that oneness with Krishna means a oneness of intention, a oneness of desire. We are eternally fragmental parts and parcels. We can never actually be Krishna, the Supreme Whole. So it's far better if we just remove any speculations that would differ from this fact. This is just the underlying fact. You can't change it. So whereas the Mayavadis waste countless time discussing and volumes of literature explaining how everything is nothing, we don't need to bother with that. We can simply accept the statements of Shastra that we are an amsha, a small part. Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. And we can interact with him. And the way to become one with him is to become one in intent, to be completely aligned to Krishna's plan. When Prabhupada came to the West, you could say, when he came to this planet even, he spent a lifetime of preparation, first of all in India, translating the Shastra, trying to publish, trying to print written manuscripts. He had the trunk full of Bhagavatams, which he brought with him when he first went to America. He prepared. He knew that Krishna wants all the living entities to be with him and not rotting in this material world. That's what he wants. And so therefore Prabhupada did something about it. He thought, let me do something in line with Krishna's wishes. And how are Krishna's wishes conveyed typically? They're conveyed through the disciplic succession, through the parampara, through the chain of gurus, and then perhaps with more detailed instruction from one's immediate guru. That is how the message of Krishna consciousness is conveyed, the specific understanding of Krishna's mission for us. Because there are countless individuals in the world, and not everyone is expected to do exactly the same thing from Krishna's perspective. Each person is unique. Just even materially, each person has unique thought processes. And so, if each person can somehow be engaged in this mission of aligning themselves to Krishna's thought process, that is one of the biggest steps, you could say the major step in entering Krishna's world. Krishna's world is a place which functions when we are aligned to his desire. And when we desire to not be aligned to his desire, which is also one of our possible desires due to our free will, he says, okay, fine, here's the material world for you. You can spend time here, play around, stay as long as you like. So those are the choices. And so our process of Krishna consciousness through the different practices, through the different literatures, is about creating a condition for ourselves whereby we will eventually be aligned to Krishna. There is absolutely no point going to a place if you can't stand the people there, you don't like the people there, you don't think like the people there, and you're simply uncomfortable, and you're expecting something which is not available. You'll be miserable. Most people in the material world are expecting name, fame, distinction, control, power, prestige, all of these things. And they strive day and night for it. If you go to the spiritual world with that attitude, you may well be seriously disappointed. Because it's not the place where you're going to have a chance to develop those things. You'll have a chance. Someone will come along and say, hey, do this for Krishna. And when you do that, you'll be in ecstasy. You'll get different reward. There'll be a different sense of satisfaction. When someone comes asking for you to be engaged in service, you'll feel the most greatest of ecstasies. You'll feel, yes, I've got to do something for Krishna, something for his pleasure, something for his plan, something for today's pastimes. And there'll be great enthusiasm, great joy. But if a person's thinking, I want prestige, I want everyone to look around, I am the chief gopi, I am the chief sakha, I am the chief Vatsalya Ras operative, then Krishna's thinking, you're in the wrong place. There's a better place for you where you can try to do that. And actually, you know, sometimes we think Krishna's made this material world and it's such a difficult place, such a troublesome place. Why didn't he just give us our independence, the independence to enjoy, and didn't give us all the negative stuff that comes with it? All the fighting, all the lack of money maybe, the disease, the old age, the suffering, the obnoxious living entities who torment me. Why did he not take these bits out of the equation? Why didn't he just give me a nice place to play around with on my own, with others following me, of course, because I want to be the Lord and Master? Well, the fact is that the only way by which you can actually have a harmonious situation is with Krishna at the center. It's not that Krishna did something extra to add a dose of trouble for us. This is something that is a natural consequence of not having Krishna in the center. When Krishna is not in the center of our activities, and we assume independent identities for ourselves, and we deal with limited resources, then at some point there's competition. There's my agenda versus yours. There's my family's agenda versus your family's agenda. My country's agenda versus your country's agenda. Dissension is just a natural consequence of not having Krishna in the center. It's not something extra special that Krishna gave along with the package. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki. So people, even devotees, when they're taking their, you can say, baby steps towards Krishna, we're all taking our baby steps, we're just sort of toddling along somehow to Krishna. We have this doubt in our mind. Why couldn't it be easier for me? I'm trying to be a devotee. Why do I have financial worries, legal worries, family worries, health worries? What is it, Krishna? Why did you make such a troublesome world? That's because we're not viewing the world with the same vision as Krishna or the Acharyas. We're viewing it with our egocentric vision, with our sense gratification vision. Those are our priorities, and that's the world we see. Actually, the experience everyone has in this world is by and large an experience created in the mind. The scene, the world that we walk in, is the world created in our mind. Obviously, there are physical constraints, and there are different inputs we get through the eyes and all of that. But what our mind operates on is then a projection created from all those inputs. Our human body allows us to have a recreation within our mind of a certain set of dimensions, certain sets of inputs. We have certain detectors that we can detect sound, smell, sight, things like that. Some other animals don't have this same world. They don't have this operating realm that we do. Some of them can only see one dimension, maybe two dimensions. Some of them have very poor eyesight, some have good hearing, some are blind. Their world is quite different to ours. Just what they see, what they think, what they envision. It's different. It's controlled by the body, but more importantly, it's to do with the mind. Because ultimately we know that the subtle body is the factor that's responsible for creating the gross body at the end of this life. The subtle body remains with us. And our formulations, our massaging of the subtle body, that molds it for the next time round. And then accordingly, we get a suitable gross body. Even if two people have similar gross bodies, their vision and the world they actually operate in can be quite different. Something happens to one person, and they draw one conclusion. The same thing happens to another person, and they draw a completely different conclusion. When someone has a disease, one person thinks, oh my God, not another disease, I've just recovered from the previous one. I've had enough of this. Krishna, why don't you just stop this? Even spiritual life I can't be bothered with anymore, because this is just annoying me. Another person may think, a disease. This entire material world is diseased. And Krishna, thank you for giving me this disease so I can realize what a deep condition of disease my consciousness is in on a day-to-day basis. Let me see that this disease is simply the external manifestation of the deep disease I have that prevents me from serving you with full faith and dedication. That's how another person could see it. Same situation, same disease, and you can apply this same logic or thinking to any of the opulences someone could have. Because everyone is striving for one of Krishna's 6 opulences in this world. And so you can see 2 people, 2 different visions. The world that this person lives in is a world of gratitude, satisfaction, and inspiration to try to serve Krishna. The world of the first person is one of perhaps some Krishna consciousness, perhaps some lazy Krishna consciousness, perhaps reluctant Krishna consciousness, perhaps doing something with a little bit of expectation from Krishna in return. It's a different world. They don't get the same level of happiness, satisfaction, contentment, inspiration, or ability to inspire someone else. But yet the situation is the same. So what we have going on in our top floor, as we say, actually governs a great deal of our life in this world. In fact, it's the major factor. It's the major factor. So we can look at the place, we can look at the consciousness, and then we can ask the question, what do we do about it? Well, it's simple, isn't it? For devotees, we know what the answer to that is. We serve. These descriptions in the Brahma Samhita, which describe the places and they describe the people, then lead to service. So I've got a few more verses from the Brahma Samhita towards the end of that chapter. And if I can find it. Yes, everyone has different activities and engagements with the Lord. And so here is one verse. It says, I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, the meditators of whom, by meditating upon him, under the sway of wrath, amorous passion, natural friendly love, fear, parental affection, delusion, reverence, and willing service, attain to bodily forms befitting the nature of their contemplation. In the Bhagavatam, it explains how there are different relationships, different activities that one can connect themselves to the Lord with. Here are some of them. The sway of wrath, anger, passion. Katamopi navena syat panchanam purusham prati tasmat kinapyupayena mana krishne niveshayat. It said in the Bhagavatam that all these persons, like the gopis came to Krishna through their lusty desires. You know, kamsa, through intense anger. And so many other descriptions are given that we tend to look at certain manifestations as being undesirable. If you're angry, you can't possibly be Krishna conscious. That's not quite correct. If you're angry like Kamsa or Hiranyakashipu, you can be Krishna consciousness 24 hours a day. Because that's all they were thinking of. Every moment was spent thinking about the impending doom that was going to come to them because of Krishna. They're factually more Krishna conscious than most of us, because they're 24 hours a day thinking of Krishna. So the verse explains that even if one thinks of Krishna in a lusty way, or in an angry way, in a passionate way, or out of even great affection and service, that results in great spiritual progress for the person. However, others, like King Vena, who was just atheistic, had no interest in Krishna whatsoever, disregarded him completely, acted as if he didn't exist, they achieved nothing. They achieve no benefit whatsoever, and their life is a complete waste. So Kamsa ultimately gets liberation. Hiranyakashipu ultimately gets great benefit, even if their method of focus was undesirable. So here where it speaks of amorous passion, anger, parental affection, like Mother Yashoda, Nanda Maharaj, reverence, willing service, maybe like some devotees, these are all ways that we relate to Krishna. We demonstrate how we are aligned to Krishna's thinking. And that means that the world that we operate in is actually a Krishna-conscious world. It's a world where Krishna is directly present. For devotees, it's very simple. We come here. We know this is Krishna's world. Krishna is there. We know through the activities that we do during the day, trying to bring others to Krishna consciousness, trying to serve Krishna's realm, trying to serve his abode in different ways, cleaning, cooking, maintaining, whatever it is, trying to do something for our own purification, to help our mind become aligned to Krishna. We experience great satisfaction, and that is Krishna consciousness. But there is also a realm available. There is a realm. There is a realm, there is thinking, there is service. And it's all waiting. So Janmashtami is always a good occasion to practically engage in service thinking of Krishna. After all, why do so many people come here after a hard day's work, several days, then work and work and work doing some fairly mundane things, possibly even if it rains, like yesterday there were some good downpours, but still devotees were doing things. Then they have a little prasadam and they go back, and they come and work again for Krishna. It's a period of the year when people are very, very Krishna conscious. It's excellent. It's just one example of what goes on typically in the spiritual world. So Janmashtami is always a time to welcome Krishna. We're hearing of different ways to enter his world. And now let's focus, from today's class, from these verses, let's focus on aligning our consciousness to be in tune with Krishna, with his desires. Then actually entering his world is very simple. Krishna simply picks us up and takes us there. That's all. It says so in the Gita. He directly picks us up. I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. Teshamaham samuttarata amritya samsara vartana. He directly picks one up from the ocean that they are loitering in and puts them straight back in his abode. So I'll stop there. If there are any questions, any comments? Yes, Antaranga Prabhu. And then Mataji.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you very much for a wonderful, insightful class. It's interesting how you went through this very particular part of Brahma Samhita, and we end up speaking very much about like our consciousness and devotional service. I really enjoyed that. Nice transition. My question is, basically, you make very interesting points, and the underlying message for me was about preaching. The message that we should align our consciousness with the consciousness of Krishna to attract the living entities into the spiritual world. So my question is, how can we align ourselves with the abilities that we possess as devotees, possibly as preachers, to the activities that we perform, which is somehow pacifying to us and also engage in a correct activity. In simplicity, how can we preach and still understand our limitations and our abilities? How can we know that? What is my field of preaching? Some of us are not speakers. Some of us are not preachers. Some of us are not book distributors. Some of us are not, you know, presenters. Mm. So, but how can we still align ourselves with the way of Krishna desire to attract the souls?
Yes, this is a very interesting question. Sometimes we don't have to plan it too much, especially in the early stages of Krishna consciousness, for the first few years, definitely. It's healthy, actually, just to be thrown in the deep end sometimes and just to have a chance to explore a whole range of different activities. Because sometimes what we've done throughout our life so far is we've created limits around ourselves. We've created barriers. Oh, I don't do this. I don't like this. I'm not going to do that. Some of it's not so substantial. It's just circumstantial. Things that we've done just through our experiences in this world. Maybe some positive, some negative. So sometimes it's useful to have a chance to set that aside. To not actually allow our past conditioning to dictate too much of what we do. So it's actually great to be sometimes told or forced to do something which is against our nature. Actually quite healthy as a means of exploration. Then you can explore what your boundaries are. I don't do this. Was it just because of some whimsical decision I made once because of some negative experience? Or is it some really fundamental limitation? Now, we know everyone has limitations, all of different types. We're limited in so many ways. Our mental capacities, our bodies, our situations in this world, the way we've been brought up. They're all factors that have constrained us and maybe empowered us also. And there are things we might like doing. But that's not always the prime quality. So my Guru Maharaj once said, typically in the beginning, we we gravitate towards services which give us a specific flavor of sense gratification that's enjoyable to us, that we get some satisfaction in. It's largely to do with our previous conditioning. There are certain things we like, there are certain things we're good at, and so we will choose a service or naturally sort of move towards a service which gives us some of that to some extent. Some people are naturally sort of outgoing, chatty people. So when they have a chance to, for example, to do some book distribution or to mingle with a large crowd, they'll love it. They'll get some kind of satisfaction which touches their heart. Others who never like that type of thing will find it very distasteful. It's still good for them to have a go at trying it out. But in over a longer period of time, one needs to be satisfied and happy in devotional life. Not so bothered with happy, actually, because that's something we learn is a temporary thing. Matra sparsha stukonteya shitoshna sukadukkada agama paino nityastam stitikshasva bharata. One is supposed to tolerate happiness and distress because it arises just like the winter and summer seasons. So even a devotee is not that bothered. Am I feeling happy today? Am I feeling distressed today? Fine, not bothered. I'm just going to carry on with my service. It's not always that easy, of course. But when we notice these feelings manifesting in us, we can feel like that. I'm feeling particularly happy. Once I wondered, why am I feeling happy today? And it was interesting, because normally you're whinging or complaining about why it's all so miserable. So once I actually thought, why am I happy today? And I concluded there was no decent reason for it. So I tried to be miserable for the rest of the day. That didn't work either, because the program for the day was for me to be happy. So these things are not to be taken too seriously. But there should be some satisfaction. There should be a feeling of consummation, a feeling of that I am at home. I'm at peace. I'm at home. I'm with Krishna. And that will come over time and experience with different services, also different people. We have to have devotees who are of the right mentality for us to feel inspired. Some of that is under our control, some of it isn't. So we just have to maneuver ourselves in our spiritual life to take the maximum inspiration that we can get. Some people will naturally inspire us more than others. So let's gravitate towards them, let's hear from them. But sometimes someone may say something to us which we don't like, and that's actually a very good thing that we need to hear. So we should not cut that off either. We just have to... You see, where I'm heading with this is that eventually, when our focus becomes Krishna conscious, full Krishna consciousness, the actual details of the dualities of this world, even the specific types of service or their flavor, starts to become less significant and less important compared to the intensity and quality of the service and the consciousness. And that's something that one has to really experience. Because in the beginning, one will simply be satisfied putting up a tent, but they'll be most displeased if someone asks them to clean the toilets. And that's just the way it is. Later on, after 20 years, they might not care whether it's a tent that's going up or whether it's a toilet that needs cleaning. And so sometimes you have to give people time also and space. And where you have successful growth of devotees, it is where there are intelligent people, intelligent leaders and preachers who do not try to make an environment that facilitates them as a priority. Immature people view the world in a certain way with their own outlook, which itself is not a full outlook. It's their conditioned outlook. And if they're given some responsibility, what they think is their service to the temple or to the world is to manifest that outlook for everyone else. They are simply immature, and they should not be given such positions. A more mature person can understand what was Srila Prabhupada's spirit when he engaged devotees in Krishna consciousness. He certainly did not give the same task to everyone. He emphasized certain things. At other times he emphasized different things, and he tried to give principles of Krishna consciousness and then some detailed application as well for individuals. So that some were told, worship Krishna on the altar, that's your only service. And as he said to some pujaris, I can give you enough work to do that will keep you occupied for 24 hours a day. And for others, if Tamal Krishna Maharaj or someone came back, and Prabhupada said, how many books did you distribute or how many devotees did you make? And the number was a bit low. Prabhupada would be, you've wasted your entire life. Just don't bother coming here unless you're going to do something substantial. So that requires vision, intelligence. And where there has been growth, success, inspiration for devotees, it's because there have been mature people who can engage people in the correct way. And so that becomes a duty also of a good preacher. And Narad Muni is one of these great preachers. You know, to someone like Valmiki or someone, he'll say, kill the animal completely. And to another person, he'll say, give up all this nonsense and just chant Hare Krishna. Completely different instructions, right? But he has the expertise to do that. So different phases of our Krishna consciousness, we will give more credibility to our needs, or our desires. In the beginning, maybe more so. You'll emphasize the delicious prasadam. You'll emphasize things that we like. You'll emphasize the company, the beautiful, scenic, the beauty of the altar, the clean pleasantness of the temple room. After a while, you can just be in Vrindavan Dham, where there's a sewer running beside you and someone making flowers right next to it, and you'll be just in as much ecstasy there as you would be here in this beautiful, clean place. So later it doesn't matter, but in the beginning it's important. So we have to think how to give people a nice experience. And the festival, this is why it's called the Mother of Devotion by our acharyas. Because in a festival, we make all sorts of fun arrangements, which are designed not to attract just the seasoned devotees, but to open, to extend a hand of accessibility to all others who are not directly interested in the pure practice of Krishna consciousness. So we have some fun, we have some games, we have some dramas, we have Pandavasena tents, we have so many things where people come, they have experiences, they have Krishna conscious connections. Little touch, maybe that's all it is. Someone's initial visit to the manor on Janmashtami could be just some samosas, some candy floss, and then maybe a little touch, they attended one of the dramas or they attended a function or something. That could be it. And years later it multiplies and grows. So we really do have a chance. And it's so much fun. I mean, no one needs to tell us that it's fun getting ready for Janmashtami and then being out there on Janmashtami. Even fasting on Janmashtami is actually fun after a while. In the beginning, maybe not. But then afterwards, fasting and then looking forward to that pink fruit salad in the evening at 12 p.m. when you break your fast. I mean, there's nothing better. So yes, different stages, different flavors, different types of enjoyment. Actually, you had your hand up, but you've gone now. So, all right. Prayojan Prabhu? Mike?
Talk about the service and how we like to choose and preferences and all this sort of thing. But also, there may be a point to consider that what would it be like if we didn't have service? That actually, it's... If that service was taken away, or that... we can no longer do it, that then you start to maybe appreciate what you have and haven't got. I think it's not a case of choosing what suits you, but to become absorbed in service, whatever it is. Mm. Because it's, like Prabhupada explains, that whatever I am doing now, I'm meant to be doing. It's part of Krishna's plan. If we could see it that way, that actually it's to please him. Mm. All I want is your causeless devotional service, it says in the Shikshakshtakam, that actually it's the service we're after, the absorption in whatever we're given, realizing that it's that actually it's all pleasing to Krishna. And that, and then if somebody takes it away, we then start to say, oh, you know, they've taken it away. I can't do it anymore. We got to appreciate the value of what we've been given, that actually it is what we're after. You know, when people space out, they say, oh, I wish I was doing, you know, they get the time, but then what do? They lose it. But, you know, and that comes from trying to choose and all those things.
Yes.
So it's really being a, just considering the points that you've got service, and that's the most valuable thing.
Yes.
That's what we're after.
Yes. Whatever service we have, it's something to be grateful for. Very important. Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, Cyrus Prabhu. Actually, no one can really take away our service in one sense. They might take away this specific manifestation of service, this specific manifestation of service, or this particular task that maybe could be managerially taken away. But service cannot be, especially in a mature stage, because the devotee will know what service they should be doing. Maybe different, but it's still a service. So as a principle, service cannot be taken away from a devotee. Prahlad Maharaj, who was prevented, directly prevented, restrained, punished for attempting to do some service, was constantly doing service. Every moment, he was in constant Krishna conscious engagement. And Hiranyakashipu couldn't understand it. How is it? I've tried to do so many things to harm you, not just taken away your service, I've tried to kill you. Where do you get your power from? Where on earth do you get it from? I am the supreme controller of all these worlds. I've conquered them. I run them by my own strength and power. And you are fearless, and I cannot do anything against you. That makes me very afraid. Where does your power come from? He said, my power comes from the same source as yours, Vishnu. And of course, that's when Hiranyakashipu lost it, as we say. He lost it. And he said, where is your Vishnu? You keep talking about this Vishnu. He is my enemy. Where is he? And then he smashed the pillar. Vishnu jumped out in his beautiful form of Lord Narasimhadev. His echinos, these dramas that Bhaktivedanta players do. This beautiful Narasimhadev coming out, roaring. Nothing quite beats that experience. And Prahlad Maharaj is in great ecstasy and everyone else is terrified. But yes, that's the point. Cannot be stopped. It's eternal. Apratihata, yayatma supresiditi. Uninterrupted. Unconditioned. Cyrus Prabhu?
I thought we were about to enter into another lecture.
No, no. That was just the interlude.
It sounds good. So Prabhu, you talk about soul, jivas going to the spiritual world, and maybe they'll find that it's not their place. Or what will they be doing there if they can't get on or perform certain services or don't like this or like that about spiritual life? Which actually, in the first place, they wouldn't be there, would they? They wouldn't be able to get there. And the other thing, the question that came to my mind was, I heard this before. Souls, do they require training when they get back to the spiritual world, the jivas? Because I could not quite understand that. I think it's asterisk, but I couldn't get it. That because the soul in itself, as you know, is not only such that it's eternal, blissful, but it's also full of knowledge. Yeah. And then to go back to the spiritual world, you need to lose the subtle body and the intelligence and desires and all this. So you don't take anything with you, like material.
That's right.
So how is it you require training?
This is where a yoga maya comes in. Everyone is full of knowledge, full of bliss, full of eternality. But Krishna, in order to conduct some pastimes, has to sometimes forget things. Because he couldn't conduct the pastime. if you knew exactly what Kamsa was about to do, you wouldn't have much of a situation of fear. Krishna wouldn't be running around scared. Or Mother Yashoda wouldn't be like that. Or Nanda Maharaj. Ultimately, Krishna will deal with any situation. But sometimes there are terrifying situations for him and his cowherd boys. And the reason is that Yogamaya acts to cover and to facilitate with a spiritual motive a person's awareness, situation, facility and everything. You see, here we are ignorant by definition. We're ignorant, we're temporary, we're unhappy. You know, asat, achit, nirananda. That's our definition here in this world. In the spiritual world, there's no shortage, nothing to be gained in that sense. Just ever-increasing relishing of rasa. Now, to heighten or to facilitate that rasa to be expressed and developed, Yogamaya creates a whole range of arrangements using many, many individuals. Vrindadevi is involved in creating the forests suitable for Krishna's pastimes. All the living entities, the gopis, they all do things to facilitate this series of pastimes. Just like we put up a tent. So there they create an arena, maybe, of gemstones or whatever it is, that will allow Radha and Krishna to meet under some strange circumstances. Or the cowherd boys will do some trick on Krishna. Those details, there's a sort of a spiritual management or an alignment which informs everyone what their role is. And there's much discussion that goes on. Radharani has parrots, right? We hear. She sends them out as messengers sometimes. Vrindadevi communicates also to all the different trees, creepers in Vrindavan. And so that they know exactly what state of blossoming or state of growth they need to be in order for this pastime to take place. So for the living entity also, the training you're referring to is training on our path of spiritual progress. So if we specifically look at sadhana bhakti, then bhava bhakti, and then within those two you have the you have the raganuga sadhana, you have the raganuga bhava bhakti, and then you have the prema bhakti. And then if you go into the divisions of those, you have an understanding that at certain stages of progression through that, and that's a whole elaborate science in itself, which has been explained by our acharyas, you, in some stages, you are trained specifically by following, specifically in the Raganuga process, you are trained by following a specific maidservant. And you learn the tricks of the trade through that specific association. And this is these are the meditations that the Goswamis would undergo. They describe that science in their books, Nectar of Instruction, Nectar of Devotion. So the specific detailed training really takes place here. In the spiritual world, ignorance is absent, so you don't need knowledge as such. Yogamaya simply manifests and facilitates whatever level of awareness that you need for that particular pastime to be for you to help in that particular pastime. So we don't have to do a health and safety training course and get the certificate at the end of it. It's not required. There you can just do anything you like. You can lift a boulder with one finger if that's what's called for. Other times you might not be able to even do anything because Yogamaya needs you to not be able to do anything. And Krishna's pastime needs you to be confused. So we say in the Gita, right, how did Arjuna become bewildered? Well, Krishna imposed that on him in order to facilitate the discussion of the Bhagavad Gita. So it's almost as if we're in the control of a different set of energies when we're up there. Thank you. Okay. I think we should stop there. Sri Brahma Samhita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Sri Krishna Janmashtami ki, Hare Krishna.